supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, it always amazes me how much territory we cover here on Voices in any given year, and 2010 was no different. It was a great year, and today we're going to kick back and take a walk down memory lane. We're going to look at some of the topics that we enjoyed, and hopefully you will enjoy as well. Well, to help me refresh my famous teeny tiny little memory are my friends and workers, co-workers, producer Jennifer Lynn and WHYY's health and science reporter Tanya English. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hey,
hello. Teeny tiny brain. Where'd you come up with that? That's ridiculous.
Oh, boy, it is so true. Later on, we're going to hear from our executive producer of Voices, Mike and Scott. Technically, she's out on maternity leave, but that's a technicality. She's going to be here in a half hour or so. So, Tanya, let's start with you. You made a short list of topics to revisit on my Monday morning conversation that air on Morning Addiction Edition. One of the topics was on the meaning of apologies. We aired that in February. And by the way, I should say to our listeners, all these chats are available anytime on newsworks.org. So tell us about apologies. Why was that on your shortlist?
You know, I think Tiger Woods gave us all kind of a lesson on how to do apologies. When his cheating, the revelations about his cheating surfaced and his marriage was falling apart, he made really a well-orchestrated public apology, but I don't think people bought it. They just didn't take it. And so we began to wonder, you know, what's a better way to say I'm sorry? And you said there, if you want to mend a relationship, there's some certain things that you should include.
Yeah. First of all, if we're going to, there's a lot of ways to say I'm sorry. You know, anywhere from I'm sorry you feel that way, which isn't really an apology. But in order for us to really apologize, we have to truly understand the harm we've caused. And we have to truly feel remorse for what we've done. Now, we can't promise the future, although we always do. You know, I'll never do that again. But if the person or people we have harmed truly feel that we understand the damage we've done, and feel compassion for the suffering we've caused, that's an apology that really hits. Now, I know this is a bad day to talk about Michael Vick, because he's our hero.
Yeah.
But that's the issue that hovers around his apology. You know, and the question is, does he really get it, what he's done? Because we're not getting that sense from him.
Well, Dan, you and I, we talked about doing a show about that, too, with Michael Vick and apologies and forgiveness. This is Jennifer speaking. And we didn't go down that road exactly. But I like what you're saying. Do you really get it? Are you just talking the talk?
Right, right. And it is about empathy, and it is about feeling remorse. Sometimes what you get is you feel regret that you got caught, and that's not where an apology comes in.
And I think people feel that from you. There's something that you do with the eyes that people just feel that from you.
Yeah, yeah.
For I have sure. a question, though, because I've been in situations where I want an apology. I really, really want one. I'm not getting one. What do you do in those circumstances?
You have a lot of choices at that point. You can feel righteous indignation. And yeah, that works. I mean, that, That works for a little while, but I heard Rabbi Kushner once said about righteous indignation. He said, it's kind of like mud wrestling with a pig. He said, you both get dirty, but the pig's going to enjoy it. You know, so you could do righteous indignation. You could hold on to anger. But, you know, really, you suffer at that point. And, you know, forgiveness is not about the person. Forgiveness is letting go of resentment, just letting it go. You're not going to get what you want. I think we'd all be happier if we let go of striving for what we can't have.
I think, too, when we lead someone else to an apology, it's a little less satisfying, even if we get it. You know, it doesn't feel like we had to walk them there instead of them coming to their own realization, too.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and Dan, I like what you said back when we did this chat in the morning for Morning Edition. You said in the first place, you know, why start off hurting each other?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, we're on the topic of relationships. Let's talk a little bit about the new monogamy. This came up both in the morning conversations that you guys have and Jennifer on Voices. You booked this show. Tell us kind of how it came to your attention.
I did book it. Well, I was reading a couple of articles in Psychotherapy Networker back in August, and it addressed the notion of what's being called the new monogamy, that today's couples, whether heterosexual or homosexual, find the nature of a committed relationship to be very important, that monogamy is a guiding principle of marriage and committed relationships in our society, and that infidelity is generally frowned upon. We pretty much agree that, most of us agree that. But our actions tell us a different story, and some of us are having conversations with our partners that indicate we want a more open relationship, or in the gay community, there can be a commitment between two people, but they also decide to have sex acts. They're okay outside of the partnership. But it's just, you know, just sex or nothing more than that in that situation. And this sounded like something worth exploring for Voices.
So the question is, what does monogamy really mean? And what do we want and need? And of course, in these days of the internet, you know, are you being monogamous if you're developing a close friend, if that relationship gets a bit more intimate online, but a person could be in another part of the world? So what really is monogamy? And these days, it needs to be defined. We are wanting, expecting fidelity, but what does that mean? We've got a clip from a Voices show we did on that topic. Mike and Scott was filling in for me at the time. She spoke with psychologist Tammy Nelson and asked her about her work with couples.
Now, in your practice, how do you handle this very difficult world? Tammy, you describe in your article that you have on occasion been fired by couples because they felt that you were too old-fashioned. So how do you walk the line in understanding what they are doing and you being open?
Well, you know, I try not to be too voyeuristic when people tell me, you know, there's sort of very complicated sexual proclivities. And to sometimes a polyamorous couple, which means poly means many and amorous means love, who have a very broad definition of who they're sexually involved with, you know, those relationships can get quite complicated. So the way that I define the therapy I do is that I don't define monogamy for a couple. I let them define monogamy. But I'm very clear that the primary relationship, the fidelity between the primary couple is really what we're working on. It's really the emotional, sexual, you know, romantic connection that's the most important. And even, you know, the new monogamy also includes what happens after an affair and however that couple defines an affair. Maybe they have three people in their, you know, open marriage, but when they cheat on someone with a fourth person, it's just as much an affair as if a couple has defined their partnership as just the two of them and someone cheats and hides it. So that we work on all the same issues as long as that primary relationship is the focus of our therapy.
So all this very fancy talk about the new monogamy and sexuality, what we're really talking about is openness and honesty and truth-telling, and where this thing goes sour is when we start to hide the truth about something we're about to do or something we've done. You know, marriages would be fine if we could be more honest, if we're feeling unhappy in the marriage, or if we run into somebody and we find ourselves attracted to them. You know, bring it back, talk about it, open it up. Let's see what this means. So it's not just about monogamy, it's about fidelity.
Right, but had you talked about, I vaguely remember you had talked about in couples mm-hmm. therapy, it does come up with you working with folks, and that it is a very difficult conversation to sort of craft between two people, what they're willing to want and put their needs out, and then what they're willing to live with, and also revisiting their conversations as they change within their relationship.
Constantly evolving, and relationships that don't evolve, that don't change, are the ones that are in trouble. But yeah, it is an awkward conversation, because we grow up in a world that says marriage is this, monogamy is this. This is what you do and what you don't do in a marriage. Well, you know, like you said in the opening, our behavior doesn't indicate that so many marriages, you know, our couples are unfaithful to each other. This stuff needs to be talked about. There can't be nothing on the table when we're having these dialogues. It's critical.
Yeah. Well, now let's go from how we connect with our partners to how having children can really change our lives dramatically. And we did a show based on a New York Magazine article by writer Jennifer Senior called All Joy and No Fun, Why Parents Hate Parenting. And I have an excerpt from that article, which I will read. It says, a few generations ago, people weren't stopping to contemplate whether having a child would make them happy. Having children was simply what you did. And we are lucky today to have choices about these matters, but the abundance of choices, whether to have kids, when, how many, may be one of the reasons parents are less happy. And we also have a clip, Dan, and it's you talking to Jennifer Senior, talking about a survey of 1,000 women in Texas that found child care rated 16th in pleasurability out of 19 activities. Let's listen.
We know about the biological imperative to have children, but if everybody on the planet were this unhappy, you know, our roads would be less congested.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting is that happiness is not necessarily an evolutionary incentive. I mean, there are many things that incentivize us before happiness does, including things like fear, right? So that's not really, clearly that's not how it works out, or at least moment-to-moment happiness. But yeah, Kahneman's study was very interesting because the women who were responding were not told explicitly that what they were, it's not like these, you know, researchers were looking to see whether they were happy as mothers, right? I mean, they were simply asking them to sort of reconstruct their days and to rate their pleasurability, how pleasurable they found certain activities. The fact that childcare managed to come in like just after housework, you know, I mean, and a million other things like napping and watching TV, they didn't know that this is how they were sort of organizing things and evaluating things. It just wound up that way. But again, what science can't necessarily capture, what social science can't capture, are deeper questions about meaning, you know, and what this all means to you. You know, I'm sure that people who were serving in World War II didn't like, you know, starving and getting frostbite, but I'm sure at the end of their lives they were very proud to have, you know, stopped the Germans, you know. So, right. I mean, again, you know, there's limits to how social science can evaluate these questions.
Yeah, and for my money, I think this was very limited. You know, think about any of us when our children were infants and toddlers. I mean, how much fun did you have changing soiled diapers? I mean, you know, that's not fun. It's messy and it stinks. You know, it's not fun. How much fun do you have, you know, bathing a child who doesn't want to be bathed? I mean, this stuff is not fun. On the other hand, how do you feel about being a mother or a father? How does that child contribute to the quality of your life? And that's a whole different answer. And most would say yes. I mean, it contributes great joy to our lives. But, You know, you raise an interesting question about, you know, this issue of choice and our narrow frame we have these days about the pursuit of happiness and how that somehow is going to make us fulfilled, how happiness will lead to well-being. It doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, I was thinking about this segment, and I am a mother of two kids, and there are moments where, you know, I want out, you know. I'll be honest about that, and I feel guilty about that, too. I don't mean out like leaving everybody, but, I mean, I just need a break. I need that nap. I need that piece of guilty pleasure TV or something, my time. And but, you know, I talk to friends of mine, and they feel similar, but they even feel more guilt, sort of, you know, expressing that. That is a challenge for parents, you know, the balance of accepting and the gratitude, you know, enjoying your family, but also needing your own little space.
There was a time when my daughter was in high school and she was going through a rough time. We were going through a rough time. Her parents had just broken up, and I was stressing and caring and nurturing and devoting time in addition to my career, and I was exhausted. And one night I had a dream that she and I did something wrong. And we both wound up in prison, she in a woman's prison, me in a men's. But I got out, and she was still in.
Left her in there?
And I woke up, and I'm thinking, yeah, I let somebody else take care of her so I wouldn't have to worry about it. And I told her about the dream the next day, you know, and I didn't realize how tired I was and how frustrated I was. But, you know, that's the deal with parenting. It's, you know, but, you know, I still love her.
I wonder if there's something generational about what Jennifer just said, because I felt very valued by my parents, but I didn't feel like I was the center of their world.
That's an excellent point. That is true. Yeah, kids have become the center of their parents' world, and that's not fun.
And one more point on that. I remember we had the marriage doctor on that show, Rita. I don't remember her last name. I'm sorry. But she talked a lot about time and time management for yourselves, for your children, trying to make it all kind of balance and work. And that was important to talk about.
Well, as long as we're talking about child-centered family, this might be a good time to bring up one of our chats, Tanya. And we talked about pushing children last month, and we talked about the importance of the first 3 years of a child's life.
Yeah, there's this really big debate about kind of the importance of these first 3 years. You know, some advocates on one side say a child's earliest experiences really can profoundly shape intelligence or achievements later on. There's some skeptics about that. But that puts really big pressure on some parents to build a better brain, that they could actually make an influence on how big their child's brain is. And so we started this conversation with a new study. It examined the effectiveness of those educational DVDs for toddlers.
Yeah, and what they found was that these DVDs like Baby Einstein are hailed as a wonder drug for some parents. The degree to which babies learn from these DVDs are negligible. Moreover, then, you know, from other data, we're learning about the harm that gets inflicted on children's brains by putting them in front of a screen. Screen time should be probably real close to zero for the first few years of a child's life.
Yeah, so this particular study was from the University of Virginia, and they looked at four groups of toddlers and really measured their ability to learn new vocabulary words. And what they found was that the kids who used the videos did not pick up any more words than the kids that just worked with mom and dad to try to learn new words. And it sounded to me like, Dan, you were saying this is just more evidence for you that what is most instructive, what is most powerful is these interactions that we have, everyday interactions with our kids.
Well, you know, there's a lot of research on family dinners. And if children who have family dinners, I think it's 3 to 4 times a week, infants talk at younger ages. Older kids are much less likely to use drugs, much less likely to befriend kids who do use drugs. Family dinners change everything. So get the kids the hell away from these screens and hang out with them. Their brains are fine. Their hearts are fine. They're going to develop just beautifully, but they'll do it even more so if you just hang out with them and stop trying to push them to be someone they're not. They'll be just fine.
And there's something kind of robotic about kids that have a big vocabulary but don't know how to connect with you or don't really know how to use those words in the right way, too.
Yeah. Do we want a nation full of people who know a lot of things but don't quite know how to use it and they're full of anxiety? And P.S., some of the research shows that that's what's happening now already. Listen, I'm looking at the clock. We are running out of time. We've got to take a 60-second break. There's more clips coming up after our break, and we'll also be talking with Mike and Scott. We're reviewing the year today on Voices in the Family, and I think we're having a good time. I certainly am. Anyway,
I am.
Yeah, there we go. And those voices you heard were our producer, Jennifer Lynn, and Health and Science Desk reporter, Tanya English. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Are you frustrated with an adolescent who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued, threatened, or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program is conducting a research study that may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend individual sessions and complete questionnaires. This study is held in Philadelphia by the Parents Translational Research Center of the Treatment Research Institute. For study details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or IamConcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
As the days get longer and the promise of spring approaches, the great Gothic Cathedral of St. John the Divine illuminates the evening sky for the 30th annual Winter Solstice celebration. I'm John Schaefer. Join me when Paul Winter and the Winter Consort welcome Teresa Thomason, the Dmitri Pokrovsky Singers, and, as always, a nationwide public radio audience. That's right here from NPR Music.
Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are taking a look back on 2010 year in review. We're playing some of our favorite clips, excerpts of our favorite shows, and our favorite discussions on Morning Edition. I'm joined by our producer, Jennifer Lynn, and Health and Science Desk reporter, Tanya English.
All right, Dan, new topic. We are all so busy, and some of us really think we're masters at multitasking. We talk on the phone while we're checking our email. We cook dinner while we're supposed to be helping the kids with their homework. But researchers say that we're really not as good as we think we are at doing multiple things at the same time. Not surprising news for you, I bet.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Is that surprising?
He was checking his email.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry. It is true. Back in the spring, we talked about it, and we did a Voices show based on the new research, which frankly was really troubling to me. The younger generation, what they researchers call digital immigrants, digital natives, the ones who were born into this stuff. They multitask more. They do it more often. They think they are more efficient at it than the older generation, who they're dubbing digital immigrants. They think they're more efficient at it, but the research shows that they are not. They're not efficient at all. They have more difficulty focusing. They have more difficulty shutting out irrelevant information, and I find I do that myself when I'm doing, checking emails and multitasking. And they experience more stress, and they can be more anxious.
Yeah. Well, Dan and Tanya, we have a clip from our show on multitasking. We have Professor Gary Small of UCLA, and he does research on memory and aging. He's talking about something called continuous partial attention. He explains what it is.
What I mean by that, think about your typical, even right now, I'm sitting in my office, and I'm working really hard to focus on this conversation, but I've got three computer screens. Now, I turned off the cell phone, that helped, but we're constantly being trained to look the other way, to notice this other information that might be coming in, that might give us the impression that it's more immediate. And we're training a whole new generation of digital natives to function that way. I think of another experience I had with my 17-year-old daughter, and I said to her, you know, Rachel, when I'm having a conversation with you, I just don't feel you're paying attention if you're texting at the same time. And so she looked up at me from her texting and said, don't worry, Dad, I don't do this with my teachers, and then went right back to her texting. So it speaks to a new culture that doesn't place a lot of value on the traditional face-to-face conversation.
Like I said earlier, this show troubled me a great deal, and part of the reason it troubled me is because what they're learning in the research is that these digital natives, their attention span is shorter, and here's what troubled me the most, that their ability for analytical thinking, for critical thinking, is impaired, and of course their social skills are impaired. But when you talk about analytical thinking being impaired, that means our chances of, talk about the political discourse. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about one-liners and, you know, one sentence or two sentence, but there's nobody saying what goes behind that, what's the real story. Nobody's interested anymore, and it greatly concerns me about what's going to happen going farther forward.
Did you have an anecdote or, a prescription for the people, the 14-year-olds in our lives who are succeeding at this? I have a 14-year-old who's the most social in her high school class. You know, she's good at this, and this is working for her where she is now.
Yeah, detox. Detox. I know one family that takes a two-week detox a year, and everybody feels rejuvenated. Mm. You know, I made a comment before this show, I think it was to you, Jennifer, that I said, I've got a little bit of an adrenaline buzz because we never did a show like this before. Well, I'm half kidding when I talk about detox, because that's what multitasking does. It gives you a buzz. When you get your brain and your body and your hormones geared up at a pretty fast clip, you get a buzz. It's like a caffeine buzz or an adrenaline buzz. I'm sure there's endorphins being released, and it feels good. So what do we do when it feels good? We do it more and more and more. And that's my concern about what's happening to us.
Well, that buzzing that you're talking about, Dan, I mean, I think I feel it too, and I know other people, when we're sort of cooking along and getting lots of things done, we all feel that. But it also, you know, it encourages our anxiety level. And then when we are talking to one another, we're more reactionary than in the moment, mindful, slowing down, appreciating what's going on around us.
Yeah, and it really is worrisome to me. We lose touch with ourselves, with who we are, with how we're experiencing things.
Now, when you're talking with individuals or families, does this come up in therapy? Are parents wondering, how do I connect with my child, because they're not even looking at me anymore?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it comes up very often. Look, I've got a friend who is 25 years old, and when we're together, we're never together. She's always texting. And I asked her how many texts she sends a day. About 100. Wow. 100 texts a day, and I think this is not unusual. So talk about continuous partial attention. We have to get them to put it down and to make eye contact. And you know, maybe I'm back to what I always harp on, you know, the family meal thing. Turn everything off. And I'm talking to parents too. You know, shut off your cell phone. If you're not a surgeon, it's not an emergency. It's not an emergency. You can turn it off for a couple hours.
Right. Give your brain a rest, it sounds like, is the prescription.
Yeah, very much so.
I can't say that I've done a lot of that lately, but one of your recent Morning Edition conversations about the power of touch kind of did give me pause, made me kind of sit still for a minute. There's growing evidence that literally connecting with people, small physical gestures, can change how others think and behave. And you, Dan, and behavioral health reporter Mike and Scott talked through this topic. Mike is going to join us a little bit later in the show, but let's listen to a part of that conversation now.
Dan, what are researchers learning about the importance and the effect of touch?
We've always known that touch was important, that there is a phenomenon called skin hunger. We need touch, that babies, when they're touched gently, tend to calm down. But these new studies are showing us some really exciting dimensions of what touch can really do, what impact it can really have. There was one study I read that was particularly interesting to me about when a patient was touched by a doctor during, after an examination, just a kind touch on the back, they experienced the visit with the doctor as twice as long as it actually was. And when a student was touched on the back gently by a teacher, they were twice as likely to volunteer for a project in class as students who were not touched. So it's got an amazing impact.
So what are we learning about why touch is so important? What happens in our body and in our brain?
We're learning now that touch, a kind touch, releases oxytocin. Now that's the trust hormone in the brain. And oxytocin cuts down on cortisol, which is the stress hormone. And if we look at it from that perspective, that once oxytocin increases and cortisol decreases, you're in a better position to make clear judgments about the future rather than just be reactive to stress.
I don't know, Dan. I'm a skeptic. It seems like I miscommunicate with people just using my words. Is it worth the risk to pat someone on the back and risk having that gesture misinterpreted? I feel like we're a hands-off culture on purpose.
Well, I personally think that we are a hands-off culture because we are a little nuts about touch. I don't think if you put your hand on my shoulder when you're trying to communicate with me, I'm going to soften up and I am going to hear you better. I don't know if that's going to be miscommunicated. Of course, you know, if you sit on my lap, that's
a whole different story. Yeah.
And, you know, we could talk about that when we're off the air. But, you know, but I mean, that's two extremes, Tanya. You know, you touch a child on the face, it helps both of you. You know, touch is a good thing. And I think our anxiety-driven culture has gotten us away from touch, which is really harmful. Yes, there are pedophiles out there, but what's the ratio of pedophiles to kind people who, when they touch, do it out of caring and kindness? That's a pretty steep ratio, you know?
I have a question. Is looking at someone a form of touch?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. But I have a bit of a bias here, and I'll tell you why. Looking at someone is almost as good as touch.
Okay.
Now, I'll tell you where my bias is. And the reason I'm biased is because, you know, I've got no sensation below my collarbone. So touch is that much more important to me when I'm touched on my shoulders or my face, or even when I'm touched where I can't feel it but can see it. It's that much more meaningful to me. So I'm a little biased when it comes to touch, but I still don't think I'm wrong, as arrogant as that is.
Well, that's interesting, because a coworker of ours, when he says hello to you on Mondays, he kind of rubs your head and such, and I feel protective of you. I'm your producer. I'm like, yo, get your hands off of Dan Gottlieb. But I didn't realize that you welcomed that and you felt good about that.
It depends on who's rubbing my head. And,
it's you've given off a sign that it's okay.
Yeah, it's not as bad as you think it is, but depending on who's rubbing my head, it's either good news or bad news, which gets us back to what Tanya said.
Right. Well, I have coached kids in sports over the years, and I have been very careful to, you know, if I'm going to touch anyone, it might be just a touch on the top of the head, very gentle, and it gets their attention. But I also find it kind of softens them, and it's a nice experience.
Yeah, it really is, and I think we should do it more because most of us are good people who want to connect with people and want to be connected with.
And maybe start with the people just outside our circle. You know, maybe you don't do the third person away from you, but people that you, you know, beyond your husband and your wife, maybe someone slightly outside of your circle just to test it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, moving onward, Dan, you and Tanya got a lot of feedback on a Morning Edition conversation the two of you had a few weeks ago, and I'll just read the introduction to that, and it goes like this. In all the frenzied preparation for family gatherings this month, don't forget to stock up on some patience and maybe a few deft conversation starters meant to include loved ones who suffer from dementia. And I really loved this because that's a population that some family members and friends have a difficult time interacting with. There's often a level of frustration, embarrassment when conversing with someone with dementia. And you two came up with some kind and clever ways to step away from the frustration and the embarrassment.
One of my favorite of your suggestions was to prepare a quiet room. And the idea was that not just the person with dementia, but all of us get just a little bit overwhelmed with the busyness. And it's nice to have a pace to go maybe one-on-one outside of all that busyness to relax and get away.
I think many of us do better one-on-one in a crowd. And I think most of us would do well to have a quiet room. But especially when you have dementia, it's easy to get overstimulated, it's easy to get confused, and I think it is a kind gesture to sit quietly with someone with dementia one-on-one. Of course, you know, there's lots of other things you can do with them. We talked about touch, and certainly holding hands, touching their face, looking in their eyes can really calm someone down, like we just talked about.
You helped me learn something about how memories are lost when you were saying maybe have conversations about when they were a child. Tell me again about that.
Well, anybody over 55 can tell you that it's recent memory that gets lost. And when you get demented, then, you know, it really begins to lose that quickly. And what you do remember is the old memories. And instead of saying to grandmom, well, remember Thursday, and telling her that three or four times, go back to her favorite, what she liked to do when she was a kid, or how she liked to cook, or what songs she liked, and those kinds of things. And, it, you know, it give her great pleasure reminiscing. And, you know, it'll probably give you great pleasure hearing about her childhood.
You also said just be kind, you know. That's a good reminder, too. It doesn't help anyone to say, like I told you three times before, here's Grandpa, you know, here's your granddaughter, Sarah.
I think the rule of thumb for people with dementia is the same as for all people. They're really trying the best they can to hold it together. And we have to understand that, and we have to be kind to them. You know, they're struggling, they're working hard to do this. We've got to check our own frustration, because it's not going to help them feel good, and it's not going to help us feel good. Well, I just glanced up at the clock again. We've got to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to talk with my dear friend, our esteemed producer of Voices in the Family, Mike and Scott, to help us continue our inventory of conversations that took place last year. I'm going to thank Jennifer Lynn, our producer. Thank you.
Fun to do this.
Thank you, Jennifer, and Tanya English.
Good to be with
thanks
you.
So much. So much fun. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Christiana Care's Center for Advanced Joint Replacement supports WHYY and wants to help you live a pain-free, active life. Located in Wilmington, just off I-95, the center offers comprehensive programs for hip and knee replacement. Their surgeons perform all of the 1,600 total hip and knee replacements conducted annually. The Center for Advanced Joint Replacement at Christiana Care is dedicated to helping patients get back to living their life fully. More information available online at christianacare.org.
Journalist Lisa Ling, she of The View, CNN, and Oprah. She's no stranger to difficult issues professionally and now personally.
I had a miscarriage. And to have had this happen, I just felt like such an incredible failure.
And now she's created the Secret Society of Women, a website where women connect, confide, and heal. Lisa Ling, Behind Closed Doors, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We are reviewing 2010, some of our favorite shows, our favorite people, and our favorite events. I am joined, speaking of favorites, by one of my favorite humans, Mike and Scott, who is our executive producer, who is technically on maternity leave as she is executive producing two children and a home. So, hi, Mike.
Hi, Dan. It's nice to see you.
It's really good to see you.
Dan, I really only came in to, first of all, introduce a very special clip from another, I think, favorite human of yours. So, before we chat, let's listen to that.
Hey, Pop, it's Sam. I just wanted to let you know that I think that you're very special because you know how to teach everybody. You always know what they're dealing with and how to deal with it. And I really like that.
Aw. That's your grandson, Sam. And I love to hear his little voice. He sounds as cute as he looks. He is one of the most precious little boys I know. And Dan, we talked about Sam earlier this year in the spring when your new book came out. It's called The Wisdom of Sam. And you first wrote Letters to Sam, which was an international, really successful book, and followed it up with Wisdom of Sam. And in our interview, you talked about your relationship and how it has grown over the years. Sam is now 10 years old. He was diagnosed with autism as a child. He's doing very well right now. And in this next clip that we're going to hear, you describe, you know, that special relationship you've always had and how the two of you have really connected. Let's hear that.
And there's something about Sam that I get. There's something about me that he gets. It's a quality of closeness. It really does go beyond words. I'll give you an example, if I may. So Sam and I, in for publicity for the book, we did a video, a book trailer, that you can find on YouTube. So we were together for 4 hours in this building, and we just hung out, and they filmed and recorded everything we did. So we were playing around on the wheelchair, racing around, we played pinball machines, we had lunch, we had serious talks, we had not-so-serious talks. And all of that was, of course, edited down to 2.5 minutes, but it was 4 hours we were hanging out. Sam said to his mother, he said, Mommy, he said, I had fun with Pop and all, but I feel we lost something private between us. And of course, you know, I hear that and I'm bereft here. And I'm ready to cancel everything, including the book. I mean, I don't want to hurt my grandson. So I called him and he says, well, Pop, he says, I've been thinking about it. Now, this is classic, Sam. I've been thinking about it. He said, Pop, what we lost between us was semi-private, not real private. He said, I'm afraid if the book gets famous and you and I get famous, that people will come up to us and say hello to us when we're out playing or at a restaurant. And he said, and I won't like that. He said, but that's semi-private. He said, what's really private between you and me, nobody can take that away. And that's Sam's remarkable insight, and that's the way Sam looks at the world, and it speaks to our relationship. Sam really is a remarkable kid. I mean, you hear it in the stories, and you hear it at the with the vignettes. I think it's partly the fact that he's on the autism spectrum, and I think it's partly the kind of kid he is. He's got two great parents. Debbie was always blessed with great insight into herself and into the world. I think Sam's got some of those genetics. But my God, what he brings to the world is just amazing. If I can tell just one quick vignette. You know, Sam, because he's Sam, for whatever reason, can't really understand meanness. I mean, one of my chapters in the book is I am more kind. I mean, he experiences himself as a very kind kid, and he is. So he doesn't understand meanness. So a kid came up to him to bully him. Now, Sam doesn't get this. And, you know, Sam's been a wrestler for a couple of years, so, he's built pretty well for a 10-year-old. And kid comes up to Sam and says, you know, I could knock you down if I wanted to. And Sam thinks for a minute, and he says, I don't know. He says, maybe you could. He says, I don't think so. He said, but maybe you could. And he walked away. You know, it's like, okay, you're giving me an opinion, a piece of data, I'll weigh it, and there it is. Nothing else to talk about.
And Sam is doing very well these days.
He's doing very well, getting straight A's in school, wonderful in math. He made the All-Star team in baseball. I mean, he's...
And I think, Dan, this story has given hope to a lot of people, and it has helped a lot of people who have children with special needs, grandchildren with special needs, to see that despite all the work and all the heartbreak that might be in a diagnosis, there's also a lot of joy, and there's a lot of good that comes with that, and I think that's one of the wonderful things that has come out of the two books about Sam.
Yeah, and it comes out with any disability, most any parent who's got a child with most any disability will say that that child made me a better person, taught me more about love than I ever have known before, and taught me a great deal about parenting. I'm just better because of it. Yeah, there's always good news.
I wanted to talk about another issue that I feel has come up a lot this year and any year we've done the show and our talks in the morning, and that's the whole issue of balance in your life, which seems like everybody is looking for, and of being present in your life and with the people you're with. And this year we did a show about life in the face of death. And I've thought a lot about that show, especially now being home with a newborn and with a toddler. I'm not thinking about death, but I'm thinking about my life and how there seems to be often a lesson at the end of life where we realize, wow, this was it. You know, this was it. All my life I've been waiting for what? For something new to start? You know, and sometimes when I'm overwhelmed and I'm sitting there with my two children and I'm thinking, I can't wait for them to go to bed so I can clean my living room or I can clean up the kitchen. I try to remind myself, what, you're looking forward to cleaning the kitchen? Like, this is it. This is the moment with your kids, right? Do you know what I mean? And I think that's something that's been so valuable to me this time and as we go into the holiday season, which can be so hectic, to just remind myself, this is the moment. This is the beautiful moment. Don't dare wish it away.
Mike, and today is December 20th, and that's the 31st anniversary of my accident. And it's funny, I'm not having a strong reaction today. I had one yesterday. Yesterday was a very emotional day for me because I thought back 31 years from yesterday. And I thought, for the first time, I thought, what if I had known? What if I had known on December 19th that was going to be my last day to walk, to touch grass, to pick up my kids, to make love to my wife, to, what if I had known that was going to be my last day? I'll tell you, I would have felt the lawn under my feet. I would have held my daughters differently. I would have tasted my food differently. I would have been more awake. And who is to know that, how dare we assume that we're going to be here another decade? How dare we? That takes us away from what's happening right now. This is precious. We have everything we need right here, right now.
And I've thought a lot about something you say often, which is to take a breath when you feel stressed out or when you feel like you're thinking ahead to the next moment or to the next day and what you have to do and how you're going to do it. to take that breath and just to think, okay, right now I'm here and everything is fine, that really seems to help.
And even if everything is not fine, just be here. You know, it's like I said earlier, when you're surrounded with 30 diapers, that's not pleasant, but you still don't want to wish it away. You still want to be awake and alive. My greatest wish for the rest of my life is to simply be alive and awake for the rest of my life. And you know what? Ain't going to happen. But but it's something I want really, really, really bad.
I was going to say, how are you doing with that?
Yeah, that's my line, honey.
I do think it's the little things. You know, if I'm sitting there with my daughter, I touch her hair, and I just want to remember how soft it is and how little her feet are. Those are the things that I think help, just reminding yourself, ooh, you know, this is really a beautiful moment. I'm sitting here with a friend right now, which is you, and we're talking, and that's great. I don't want to think about that we have to close the show in 30 seconds.
No, I don't either. But that's the point. You're right. We do miss so much of our lives, and every now and then I find myself literally waking up and being aware of what a gift this is. You know, I wrote in my book about a friend of mine who asked me if I believed in heaven, and instantly I said, yeah, this is it. This is it. What are our chances of having a life, of being surrounded with love? So, like it or not, we're out of time.
But something to keep in mind this holiday season especially.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike. It was great being with you again. Earlier today, we heard from our producer, Jennifer Lynn, Health and Science Desk reporter, Tanya English, and we reviewed our show. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Next week, we're going to have a rebroadcast of our show on listening. Well, as you know, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. I would love to hear from you. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Maggie Zahn and Stephanie Pena are our interns. This is Maggie's last day with us. My heart's broken, but I will recover. She's graduating, and we wish her the best. The world awaits you, Maggie. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week. Enjoy the holidays. Enjoy the new year, my friends. See you soon.